Chapter 6 Jane Eyre, A Short Excursion into the Novel. Outside Styx's apartment was not the first time Rochester and I had met, nor would it be the last. We first encountered each other at Haworth House in Yorkshire, when my mind was young, and the barrier between reality and make-believe had not yet hardened into the shell that cocoons us in adult life. The barrier was soft, pliable, and, for a moment, thanks to the kindness of a stranger and the power of a good storytelling voice, I made the short journey and returned. Thursday next, a life in Speshops. It was 1958. My uncle and aunt, who even then seemed old, had taken me up to Haworth House, the old Bronte residence, for a visit. I had been learning about William Thackeray at school, and since the Brontes were contemporaries of his, it seemed a good opportunity to further my interest in these matters. My uncle Mycroft was giving a lecture at Bradford University on his remarkable mathematical work regarding game theory, the most practical side of which allowed one to win at snakes and ladders every time. Bradford was near to Haworth, so a combined visit seemed a good idea. We were led around by the guide, a fluffy woman in her 60s with steel-rimmed spectacles and an angora cardigan, who steered the tourists around the rooms with an abrupt manner, as though she felt that none of them could possibly know as much as she did, but would grudgingly assist to lift them from the depths of their own ignorance. Near the end of the tour, when thoughts had turned to picture postcards and ice cream, the prize exhibit in the form of the original manuscript of Jane Eyre greeted the tired museum-goers. Although the pages had browned with age and the black ink faded to a light brown, the writing could still be read by the practiced eye, the fine, spidery long hand flowing across the page in a steady stream of inventive prose. A page was turned every 2 days, allowing the more regular and fanatical Bronte followers to read the novel as originally drafted. The day that I came to the Bronte Museum, the manuscript was open at the point where Jane and Rochester first meet, a chance encounter by a style.
"Which makes it one of the greatest romantic novels ever written," continued the fluffy yet lofty guide in her oft-repeated monologue, ignoring several hands that had been raised to ask pertinent questions. "The character of Jane Eyre, a tough and resilient heroine, drew her apart from the usual heroines of the time, and Rochester, a forbidding yet basically good man, also broke the mould with his flawed character's dour humour. Jane Eyre was written by Charlotte Bronte in 1847 under the pseudonym Currer Bell. Thackeray described it as the masterwork of a great genius. We continue on now to the shop where you may purchase picture postcards, commemorative plates, small plastic imitation Heathcliffs, and other mementos of your visit. Thank you for..."
One of the group had their hand up and was determined to have his say.
"Excuse me," began the young man in an American accent.
A muscle in the tall guide's cheek momentarily twitched as she forced herself to listen to someone else's opinion.
"Yes?"
she inquired with icy politeness.
"Well," continued the young man, "I'm kind of new to this whole Bronte thing, but I had trouble with the end of Jane Eyre."
"Trouble?"
"Yeah. Like, Jane leaves Thornfield Hall and hitches up with her cousins, the Riverses."
"I know who her cousins are, young man."
"Yeah, well, she agrees to go with this drippy St. John Rivers guy, but not to marry him. They depart for India, and that's the end of the book? Hello? What about a happy ending? What happens to Rochester and his nutty wife?"
The guide glowered.
"And what would you prefer? The forces of good and evil fighting to the death in the corridors of Thornfield Hall?
That's not what I meant, continued the young man, beginning to get slightly annoyed.
It's just that the book cries out for a strong resolution, to tie up the narrative and finish the tale. I get the feeling from what she wrote that she just kind of pooped out.
The guide stared at him for a moment through her steel-rimmed glasses and wondered why the visitors couldn't behave just a little bit more like sheep. Sadly, his point was a valid one. She herself had often pondered the diluted ending, wishing, like millions of others, that circumstances had allowed Jane and Rochester to marry after all.
"Some things will never be known," she replied noncommittally. "Charlotte is no longer with us, so the question is abstract. What we have to study and enjoy is what she has left us. The sheer exuberance of the writing easily outweighs any of its small shortcomings."
The young American nodded, and the small crowd moved on, my aunt and uncle among them. I hung back until only I and a single Japanese tourist were left in the room. I then tried to look at the original manuscript on tiptoe. It was tricky, as I was small for my age.
"Would you like me to read it for you?"
said a kindly voice close at hand. It was the Japanese tourist. She smiled at me, and I thanked her for her trouble. She checked that no one was around, unfolded her reading glasses, and started to speak. She spoke excellent English and had a fine reading voice. The words peeled off the page into my imagination as she spoke.
"In those days I was young, and all sorts of fancies, bright and dark, tenanted my mind. The memories of nursery stories were there among other rubbish, and when they recurred, maturing youth added to them a vigor and vividness beyond what childhood could give."
I closed my eyes, and a thin chill suddenly filled the air around me. The tourist's voice was clear now, as though speaking in the open air, and when I opened my eyes, the museum had gone. In its place was a country lane of another place entirely. It was a fine winter's evening, and the sun was just dipping below the horizon. The air was perfectly still, the color washed from the scene. Apart from a few birds that stirred occasionally in the hedge, no movement punctuated the starkly beautiful landscape. I shivered as I saw my own breath in the crisp air, zipped up my jacket, and regretted that I had left my hat and mittens on the peg downstairs. As I looked about, I could see that I was not alone. Barely 10 feet away, a young woman, dressed in a cloak and bonnet, was sitting on a stile watching the moon that had just risen behind us. When she turned, I could see that her face was plain and outwardly unremarkable, yet possessed of a bearing that showed inner strength and resolve. I stared at her intently with a mixture of feelings. I had realized not long ago that I myself was no beauty, and even at the age of 9 had seen how the more attractive children gained favor more easily. But here in that young woman, I could see how those principles could be inverted. I felt myself stand more upright and clench my jaw in subconscious mimicry of her pose. I was just thinking about asking her where the museum had gone, when a sound in the lane made us both turn. It was an approaching horse, and the young woman seemed startled for a moment. The lane was narrow, and I stepped back to give the horse room to pass. As I waited, a large black and white dog rushed along the hedge, nosing the ground for anything of interest. The dog ignored the figure on the stile, but stopped dead in his tracks when he saw me. His tail wagged enthusiastically, and he bounded over, sniffing me inquisitively, his hot breath covering me in a warm cloak and his whiskers tickling my cheek. I giggled, and the dog wagged his tail even harder. He had sniffed along this hedge during every single reading of the book for over 130 years, but had never come across anything that smelled so, well, real. He licked me several times with great affection. I giggled again and pushed him away, so he ran off to find a stick. From subsequent readings of the book, I was later to realize that the dog, Pilot, had never had the opportunity to fetch a stick, his appearances in the book being all too few, so he was obviously keen to take the opportunity when it presented itself. He must have known, almost instinctively, that the little girl who had momentarily appeared at the bottom of page 81 was unfettered by the rigidity of the narrative. He knew that he could stretch the boundaries of the story a small amount, sniffing along one side of the lane or the other, since it wasn't specified. But if the text stated that he had to bark or run around or jump up, then he was obliged to comply. It was a long and repetitive existence, which made the rare appearances of people like me that much more enjoyable. I looked up and noticed that the horse and rider had just passed the young woman. The rider was a tall man with distinguished features and a careworn face, bent into a frown by some musings that seemed to envelop him in thoughtful detachment. He had not seen my small form, and the safe route down the lane led right through where I was standing. Opposite me was a treacherous slab of ice. Within a few moments, the horse was upon me, the heavy hooves thumping the hard ground, the hot breath from its velvety nose blowing on my face. Suddenly, the rider, perceiving the small girl in his path for the first time, uttered, "What the deuce?" and reined his horse rapidly to the left, away from me, but onto the slippery ice. The horse lost its footing and went crashing to the ground. I took a step back, mortified at the accident I had caused. The horse struggled to gain a footing, and the dog, hearing the commotion, returned to the scene, presented me with a stick, and then barked at the fallen group excitedly, his deep growl echoing in the still evening. The young woman approached the fallen man with grave concern on her face. She was eager to be of assistance and spoke for the first time. "Are you injured, sir?" The rider muttered something incomprehensible and ignored her completely. "Can I do anything?" she asked again.
"You must just stand on one side," answered the rider in a gruff tone as he rose shakily to his feet.
The young woman stepped back as the rider helped his horse recover with a clattering and stamping of hooves. He silenced the dog with a shout and then stopped to feel his leg. It was obvious that he had hurt it quite badly. I felt sure that a man of such dour demeanor must surely be very angry with me. Yet when he espied me again, he smiled kindly and gave me a broad wink, placing a finger to his lips to ensure my silence. I smiled back, and the rider turned to face the young woman, his brow furrowing once more into a grimace as he fell back into character. High in the evening sky, I could hear a distant voice calling my name. The voice grew louder and the sky darkened. The cold air warmed on my face as the lane evaporated, the horse, rider, young woman, and the dog returning to the pages of the book whence they had sprung. The room in the museum faded in about me, and the images and smells transformed back into the spoken word as the woman finished the sentence.
"For he halted to the stile whence I had just risen and sat down." "Thursday!" cried my Aunt Polly crossly. "Do try to keep up. I'll be asking questions later."
She took me by the hand and led me away. I turned and waved my thanks to the Japanese tourist, who smiled genially back at me. I returned to the museum a few times after that, but the magic never worked again. My mind had closed too much by the time I was 12, already a young woman. I only ever spoke of it to my uncle, who nodded sagely and believed every word. I never told anyone else. Ordinary adults don't like children to speak of things that are denied them by their own grey minds. As I got older, I started to doubt the validity of my own memory, until by my 18th birthday I had written it off as the product of an overactive imagination. Rochester's reappearance outside Styx's apartment that night served only to confuse. Reality, to be sure, was beginning to bend.